Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffel, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lauffel, and today is, it's an anniversary. Today is, of course, the day that we dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and, you know, it marks 80 years not only of that date, but 80 years that we've had no great power wars, and for many of us, we attribute that to the United States having a compelling nuclear arsenal that has brought about great peace. Now, to discuss that original event, we have, I don't know who else would be better to have on NucleCast than General Paul Tibbetts, who, his grandfather, he himself is a retired bomber pilot, and his grandfather was, of course, the man who dropped that bomb. And so who better to talk about that date and the events surrounding it than the grandson of the pilot himself? So, Nuke, welcome to NucleCast. It's good to have you.
Adam, really a pleasure. I know you'd rather have my grandfather here, and frankly, so would I. But we can't. He lived a great life, but he's not with us anymore. So thanks for having me, and thanks for the work you're doing. It's fantastic.
So, for many people who may not have heard this, the story before and have ever heard you speak, tell us, take us back and then walk us forward. What do we need to know and understand, not only about that day, but about your grandfather and about sort of what that event meant?
Sure. Be happy to, Adam. I was very fortunate because he lived a long life. And so I got to spend some time with him in his later years, when he was retired. He had a job after that. He worked for 20 more years, and so it was awesome to be able to spend some time with him. And some of my fondest memories are sitting there watching him sign books, and these men, and some women too, but a lot of men who were, my father's generation, my generation, with walking up with tears in their eyes. I mean, literally tears in their eyes going, sir, I get chills just thinking about it. They're like, I've always wanted to meet you. And my grandfather, one of the most humble yet focused, serious, but had a good time later in life, just enjoyed his life. People you would have ever met. But if we just take a step back for just a minute, oftentimes, I get questions. Why you? Not so much about why the event as much, but that's a conversation too. But why you? And Granddad happily would talk about that. And he'd say, "Look, I'm not sure. I know what I did. I know my record. And if you go back and look at his time in the B-17, and Adam, I know you're very familiar with that. A lot of our listeners probably are. Amazing." Led the first daylight bombing mission into German-occupied France, right? I mean, in ruin. And that mission itself is so well-known. I mean, this is the beginning of high-altitude daylight bombing. I mean, the first mission. And he led it. Now, if you read the history books, they'll credit some other more senior individuals that were flying with him. I'll just leave it at that. and that's fine. My grandfather said, look, I get it. But my job was to make sure that mission could be as successful as it could. And so he was the one that planned it or put all the time to build it. And then of course flew it in the lead airplane. So that started it, right? Adam, that started this, who is Paul Tibbetts, but it doesn't end there. He flew several important missions in the B-17, his favorite airplane, by the way, the Red Gremlin was his nose art. When he was old and, later in life, his tire wheel cover on the back of his car was a nose art, a painting of the nose art of the B-17, Red Gremlin. So just loved it. But
oh, cool.
uh, flew several missions in the B-17. I mean, we know about him flying with General Mark Clark, Eisenhower. We know about them coining him as the best pilot in the Army Air Corps. Not cliche, I heard it somewhere. It's true. It was a fact. And they trusted him. We know about him going to Northern Africa and standing up. I think about this, just the enormity of just this event where he stood up a combat operation in the middle of nowhere with just a few airplanes. He had to find bombs. He had to find fuel. He had to set up an operation. And then he flew out of there. He flew combat, very successful combat operations out of there. So we know about that, right? And then we know that he spent some time out of the war because they needed somebody to go, his terms, figure this airplane out. You know, how are we going to fly a B-29? How are we going to make it airworthy so that we're not concerned about it catching fire? We're concerned about being a successful bombing platform. And they brought him back to the United States for a year to do that. And then, lo and behold, he was hired, you know, back in 1944 to lead this effort called the Manhattan Project, you know, and train the crews for this effort. So I'll stop there, Adam. But, you know, when people say, how did it happen? He goes, well, all I know is I was the youngest guy being considered. My name was maybe late to the negotiation, but I was the one they wanted for all those things we just talked about.
Yeah, I could imagine that, you know, if you were considered the best pilot in, you know, in the Army Air Corps, the Army Air Forces, that, you know, you would be the one they were like, hey, well, how about that guy? And they would choose a more junior guy because they trusted his flying ability on a no-fail mission. And okay, so what we sort of understand, and you guys are from Louisiana, your family's from Louisiana, you know, and it's like so many, you know, Claire Chennault and others who were just sort of farm kids who turned out to be really good at stuff. You know, Eisenhower was a farm kid from Kansas. You know, you have all of these people that sort of had this very normal, simple upbringing that ultimately did great things. So he's picked. So now that he's picked, then what?
Yeah, well, Adam, it's interesting you mentioned this. My grandfather grew up in the Midwest. It's just, you can't make this stuff up. Just a young boy who had a dream of flying. And that dream clearly paid huge dividends for our nation and for the world. And so now he's picked. And he's told by General Nett, you're the man. And you're going to organize and train a group of aviators using the B-29. Right, we've talked about that, to deliver a weapon that we're frankly still developing. And so your job right now is to get after it. And so my grandfather, I said, very focused, you know, a man who understood his mission. He understood that based on the information that not only he was told by his leadership, but also through the scientists that he met in Los Alamos, including Oppenheimer, Groves, you know, all these folks that he was associated with. That if they were successful, and he was determined, they were going to be successful, right? To the best of his ability. I mean, there's things you can't control, but he was determined. He said, we're going to be successful, and we're going to bring this war to an end, and we're going to save lives. And that was his focus for the next 6 to 8 months. You know, you think about the timing of this. This is the fall of 1944. And they left and went to Tinian in the spring of 1945. So that was that first period I was talking about, you know, when they were getting ready for the mission and training. Now, clearly, we didn't drop the bomb until August, you know, August 6, 1945, while they were on Tinian preparing for this. So in that first period, Adam, when they're preparing, there was a lot to figure out. You know, we think about the B-2, for example, this bomber up, you can see up above my shoulder here. One of the engineers involved said, yeah, we had a patent a day for a long period of time. Well, the B-29 was kind of like that, right? It was a new airplane. We had just started flying it. As a matter of fact, the squadron they picked was the 393rd Bombardment Squadron, they're called back then, the Bombardment Squadron. And they had a good record, but they were novices. This was a new airplane that my grandfather had just tried to help the Army Air Corps figure out, you know, how are we going to make this thing something we can fly in combat? And so that was his job. And so he started with what he knew. And he picked his navigator and his bombardier from his time in the B-17 from the Red Gremlin. Navigator was Dutch van Kirk, and his bombardier was Tom Farabee, two fantastic gentlemen whom I had the pleasure to meet years later before they passed away. And he said, look, Tom and Dutch, you can't really get, you know, the details, can't get into too many of them because, you know, he was sworn to secrecy, right? This was understanding that if information got out about this mission, it could be detrimental to the mission itself. Sure. They had to keep this under wraps. But he said, hey, we're going to train to deliver a weapon. And if we're successful, we can bring this war to an end sooner and save countless lives. And so Tom was the bombardier that trained the bombardiers in the 393rd Bomb Squadron. Dutch was the navigator, did the training for the navigators. And my grandfather's job, of course, was to work with the pilots and to work to design the mission. And so I think, Adam, just not to carry it on too long, what they had on their plate was, okay, how are we going to make sure we maintain security? We keep, we keep this mission under wraps. How are we going to get everybody trained? And we got to develop the tactics that did not exist for not only flying the mission itself. You know, that's interesting. But more importantly, after we release this weapon, how are we going to fly the airplane? How are we going to maneuver the airplane to survive so that we can actually come back home and, you know, and live to tell another day, live to continue to fight? And so all those things together were a huge challenge for him. And he did talk about a lot of those. We can get into anything that you'd like to. There's a lot there. But that was what was on his plate. And clearly, because he was the only one in the outfit that understood the exact intricacies of the mission, he's also the one that had to figure out, okay, we're going to train. Where are we going to train? And then how long are we going to stay there before we move forward? And, of course, they were moving forward to Tinian. All of that were things that he had to consider throughout this time period.
And so what were the big challenges in getting ready for this mission?
Well, I'll talk about one of the first ones because I think it's a funny story, interesting story. My grandfather, creative. A brilliant man. It takes someone that's not only a good tactician, and you mentioned that, that's proven himself, but also has got the mental capacity to handle all of this. And my grandfather was certainly that guy. So here's a kind of funny one. So they got to Wendover. And he knew he was assigned a security outfit, some military and civilians, to help monitor, to make sure that they kept this thing, you know, under wraps, under control, and word didn't get out what they were really planning to do, right? What was the real mission? And so my grandfather was like, well, how are we going to test this, right? We need to make sure that people understand I'm serious. When I say what happens here stays here, I mean that, right? I'm serious about this. And so here's what he did, a couple things. One is he said, you know what I'm going to do? We're still waiting for the airplanes to arrive. They were still setting up when he got to Wendover, you know, when the people got there. Sure. He said, I'm going to release everyone on 2 weeks of leave, basically, of time off. And we're going to place some of our Secret Service folks at the choke points. You know, back then, it was basically the train stations, the bus stations, you know, where the bars, where people are going to hang out. They're going to be in civilian clothes. They're, you know, kind of Secret Service kind of guys. And we're going to put them in these areas and allow them to just sort of strike up conversations and see if they can get people to talk. Well, as you can appreciate, Adam, some people like to run their mouths. And so what happened was some people started to run their mouths. So they would come back and say, okay, you know, Colonel Tibbetts, he was a lieutenant colonel at the time, then made colonel. Before the mission, he said, okay, Colonel Tibbetts, so we've got some talkers. And Granddad said, okay, great. I want all the talkers to report back to Wendover immediately. And he left everybody else on leave. And so he brought these guys back, brought them into a room, and basically read them the riot act. And said, look, you at this place, this location, at this time, with this individual, he looked like this. Excuse me. You said this. He had them. Right? He had him. And he said, okay, look, I told you not to talk. And they didn't know anything. The funny thing is they didn't know anything. They're like, well, we're part of something special. We don't know what it is, but it's going to be big, you know? And let's just say that the individuals that were running their mouths were given the opportunity to spend the rest of the war in a very isolated location, far away from any people. The second story I'll tell you, which is also very quick, is he would listen to their phone calls. And during one phone call, a young man's wife was pregnant. When he found out, it was when he was on the phone with them. So as soon as they hung up the phone, my grandfather walked up to the young man. He said, "Hey, congratulations on your upcoming birth of your baby." And the guy's like, "So word spread fast, Alan. Adam, I don't call you Adam. Adam, the word spread fast. And what happened down the road was people began to trust my grandfather because he did what he said, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you minded your P's and Q's, if you did your work, then he knew he had their back. He's like, "Look, I'm going to take care of you guys. You just do what I need you to do." And so as they marched down the road, challenges ensued with how they were going to fly the escape maneuver for dropping the bomb. And I mentioned that earlier, and I need to tell that story because that one's very interesting. But he met with the scientists. They discussed what the plume was going to be, and as best they understood, you know, from the physics of the weapon. And it was an airburst, right? So how is this going to work? And they said, "Paul, what we need you to design this escape maneuver. You need to be so far from the blast at so much time in order to survive, you know, in order to not get any damage on the airplane," right? So he designed this escape maneuver that, no kidding, still existed when I got into B-1s as a young lieutenant. We still had the same maneuver when we had a similar mission. And it was max performing the airplane and maneuvering it in a turn, a tangent to the ever-expanding circle of the plume, of the blast, to get as much distance as they could, turning for about 120 degrees and then rolling out and then extending from there. And that was the maneuver. So he designed the maneuver. Then he taught everyone how to fly that maneuver. And it was speaking of a no-fail mission, it was a no-fail maneuver.
Yeah.
Now, the airplane itself, because he had test flown the B-29 back before this happened, and he had one that didn't have the armor plating, he knew that his aircraft needed to be lighter in weight to get up to 30,000 feet to carry this weapon. And so when he had his special silver plate aircraft built, he had them built without any armor plating so that they could not only get to altitude but also fly this maneuver to survive the blast from the actual release of the weapon. And so that was another thing that he had to come up with, was how are we going to actually execute this part of the mission? And then if you think about just a bunch of guys, young men, very young. My grandfather wasn't as young, but they were very young. Out there in the middle of nowhere, Utah, there was some misbehaving going on. And so he had to take care of the misbehaving, and he tells a few funny stories about guys getting in brawls in downtown Wendover. It's people, right? It's leading people. And he did a great job with that. He'd bring them in and he'd say, "Look, you know, you got to behave yourself. We got an important mission to get done here." And he would walk, you know, through each one of these incidences with professionalism and lead his group. And I was told years later when I got to hang out with him and some people that served with him that people loved working for him because he was clear. He was concise. His expectations, as long as you met him, you were good, right? You were good to go.
Oh, that's nice. That's a neat one. Well, now it's that time of the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll do that. And when we come back, I want you to let's go ahead and get to Tinian. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be on Tinian when we come back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back and we're talking to General Paul Tibbetts, and we're talking, you know, today's the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. So now you've told us about your grandfather and kind of the leader that he was. So now move us to Tinian, where, you know, we're preparing for this no-fail mission.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Adam. Again, a pleasure to be here. My grandfather's definitely, he's my hero. And I don't say that, you know, tongue in cheek. I mean it. And I mean it because not only do I respect what he did and the kind of leader that he was, and of course the enormity of the work that he had to get done when he got to Tinian. I mean, we know now how that went, but they didn't know back then. They were just preparing and trying to be ready. And so there was a lot of weight on his shoulders. And when he got to Tinian, he was isolated. He was put on a part of the island that was away from everybody else. There was already B-29s there, as we know from history. They were flying combat missions. We know the types of missions they were flying. Very important missions that General May had going on. We had, you know, there was a lot going on right during this time. And so my grandfather had a couple of concerns at this point in the development of this project. And one is maintaining secrecy, right? I mean, he still had to make sure that, hey, we're not playing I Got a Secret, but we kind of are, because we can't talk about this mission, and we have to be able to execute this without tipping anybody off. Okay, that was a big one. And the second one was maintaining their I'll call it their proficiency, being ready to go do this mission when the call came, because they still were working through the date, right? They're still working through. This is in the spring, and we know it happened in the early fall. So there's a time period there, and so he had his men flying missions, you know, dropping bombs. I mean, you had to be careful because they were already specially trained. They spent months and months preparing. So there's a risk here, but he didn't want them to get rusty. And so there's this balance he's trying to maintain during this time. And you can appreciate that challenge. I mean, it's a huge challenge. They got through most of the, I'll call it the initial training over in Wendover. They knew the maneuvers they were going to fly. All the tactics were worked out. Now it was just maintaining readiness as they got to Wendover.
And did they have any sense that it was going to be an atomic bomb that they were going to drop? When they were dropping, you know, they were practicing these runs and dropping, you know, mock-up, was it like a fat man or little boy sort of dummy bomb? Or
It was, Adam. Okay. So interesting. Well, and I've read some things recently. I had to dig because my grandfather talks about it a little bit in his book, but I had to go find some other resources because I was curious about how many of the little boy type bombs did they make? Well, they only made, I think it was 7 is the right number. And don't hold me to that. It was somewhere in that number. It was less than 10. And most of the, you know, the production was in the Fat Man, because that was going to be the follow-on to this effort, right? So, and we know that now. But back then, that was what was happening. So they only dropped a handful, like 3 or 4 of the little boy, Adam, in test. And then a bunch of the pumpkin bombs. That was the main test article. They didn't know. They knew it was a special weapon, Adam. And you just had to use words like that, right? You had to use words like that because you didn't want anything leaking out. So, yeah. So now they're on Tinian and they're doing what they can to stay proficient. And I'll just say, this is talked about in some of the interviews and things you can find about my grandfather, but there was some animosity against the 509th because they were flying, but not a lot. And all these other guys were in combat every day and, you know, lives were being lost. It was heavy, right? This is war. And what's the 509th doing, right? And there's a little poem that makes fun of the 509th. So General Davies was commander of the B-29s on Tinian, except for the 509th. And he paid a visit to the 509th one day. There's a famous story about that. I'll give you the brief version because, you know, I know we don't have a lot of time. But the brief version is that he came out to visit the 509th composite group one day. And my grandfather was flying. And there was a young airman who was guarding the, I'll call it the secure area that they had.
Sure.
He was guarding the secure area, and he was just 19 years old, right? Just young MP. I said airman, I'm sorry. This Army Air Corps, right? So young MP. And so as the story goes, General Davies shows up, and everybody knows who General Davies is. I mean, he's the highest-ranking officer on Tinian. And he explains about his interest in seeing what's happening in the 509th and wants to come in. And this young man said, well, General, I'd be happy to let you in, except I just need to see your credentials. Well, General Davies didn't have credentials to get into this area. So as the story goes, they go back and forth a couple times. The young man goes to call my grandfather. Grandfather's flying, you know, hey, as soon as Colonel Tempest gets back, I'm sure he'll take care of you. No, I want to come in now. So he drops his ID card at the feet of this young MP and starts to walk in. This guy cocks his rifle, he points at him and says, General, if you take one more step, I'm going to have to shoot you. So let's just say that General Davies did not take one more step. He went back to his office and left a note for my grandfather to call him when he landed. Now, you got to think, Adam, today if something like that happened, what would happen? There'd be a bunch of staff, you know, officers, people preparing PowerPoint briefs, figuring out how they're going to apologize to this guy. They would have gotten a hold of my grandfather and had him land immediately, you know. None of that happened, right? We didn't have PowerPoint back then. He was flying. There's no way to reach him. And so when he landed, at hours later, he had a note on his desk saying, Jill Davies wants to talk to you. That was it. So my grandfather went and reported in, you know, Sir Colonel Tibbetts reporting his order, and says he relayed the story to my grandfather. And he said, Paul, I just got one question for you. Had I taken one more step, would he have shot me? And my grandfather said, absolutely. And he said, that's great. That's why I came back here and waited for you to land. So, I mean, a little bit humorous, but it gives you a sense of the people that my grandfather had working for him, the kind of leader that he was. And he went and thanked that young man later. I mean, just, hey, you got to imagine this young man and the pressure he was under when this general was in front of him, right? But he did his job, right? Everybody did what they were supposed to do, Adam. Everybody performed in the way they were supposed to perform. And so when they were ready to go on August 6, 1945, there was no doubt that barring anything, you know, that they hadn't thought about already, which they thought through every conceivable, you know, permutation of what might happen, this was going to be a success.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so we're going to take as much time as we need, so don't worry about time. Now move us through, so it's the day for the mission. Talk about that.
So there's a lot of interesting facts and in stories in this time period, because as you can appreciate, and as I've shared already with you and your audience, that my grandfather was just a matter of fact, you know, straight shooting guy, but he also didn't think he had to explain himself. And by that, I mean that he had always planned on flying the first mission. Now, General LeMay and some others had talked to him about maybe not flying it. That's true. But he said, look, I'm in charge. I'm gonna lead from the front, is the way I phrase it. I don't think my grandfather phrased it exactly like that, but I'm going to lead from the front. I'm going to fly this mission, not because I need the notoriety or anything like that. I want to make sure that if anything happens, that I'm there. And that's the kind of leader that he was. And so on the day before the mission, they painted Enola Gay on the airplane that belonged to Bob Lewis. He was the aircraft commander. He was the pilot in command of that airplane. And Bob always thought that he was going to fly the mission, that if it was going to be flown, he was going to fly it. Well, my grandfather said, you'll fly. But what he meant was, you'll fly as my co-pilot, right? But he never, like I said, he never felt like he had to explain himself. Well, Enola Gay got put on the airplane, and Bob, you know, hit the ceiling, right? I mean, he was like, what are you doing to my airplane? Who authorized this? And they said, well, Colonel Tibbetts did. So Lewis found my grandfather, and he said, absolutely, I did. And that was kind of the end of that conversation, by the way. That, yes, I did. And that was it. So, you know, Bob was an interesting gentleman. I never got to meet him. He wasn't alive later in life when I got to spend time with my grandfather and the surviving members of his crew. So I didn't have the pleasure of being able to spend any time with him. But my grandfather respected him. He said he was a fantastic pilot, and he trusted him. But again, my grandfather was in charge, right? So the day of the mission, they show up, you know, they have their breakfast, and they talk about going out to the airplane. Interesting time period, because they're taking off in the morning, right? It's dark. And they've got all these lights because they basically want to capture all these moments, right? Because they knew this was going to be a big mission. They had some professional cameramen there and other folks there that were recording everything that was taking place. And I think you're familiar with this, Adam, but on his book and in other circumstances, there's a picture of him leaning out of the airplane, kind of looks like he's waving his hand.
Oh, yeah. Right.
He's not waving his hand. He's telling them to get the lights out of the way so he can start the airplane. So kind of funny story, right? He's like, we got to get started. It's time to go. And he wasn't interested in the pomp and circumstance, right? He's like, it's time to go, right? We have a mission to get done. So that, you know, even though he's smiling, interesting, he's saying, get out of the way, right? We need to get moving politely. I mean, he wasn't rude about it. And so on this particular day, right, it's the day in history, right? They start up the airplane and they prepare to take off. And my grandfather would tell you, if he was here, Adam, he would say, and this is not meant to be anything other than exactly how it sounds. He said, that was one of the most boring flights I've ever had. Now, of course, they were nervous. Of course, there was a lot at stake. But what he meant was, everything went as it was planned. We had thought through everything we could think of, right, from the other B-29s that were flying with them, right? They had a weather ship that was out there. They had that was going to fly over, two of them actually, to fly over the other, the secondary, third, tertiary targets so that depending on, you know, all three of them, depending on which one had the best weather, the first one did, then they would, of course, would prosecute that target, right? If not, they go to the second target, not the third target. So each of these airplanes had to fly over these targets and provide weather reports. They also had an instrumentation airplane that was going to drop some equipment to record the effects of, you know, the bomb, right? To record everything from the weapon itself. And so this was not just the Enola Gay. Then they had a backup airplane. And so there's a lot of logistics going on here to make sure that this was going to be successful. Their target for this first mission for Hiroshima was clear. And so they prosecuted the primary target. On the way to the target, he explained to the crew what they were doing. So people always ask, like you did, so did they know? Well, they did know on that flight. It is true that obviously there's a lot of information that this crew had about the development of this effort, right? And all the way through to execution. And so they did have capsules because there was a strong desire for no one to be captured, if I can put it that way. So they would do what they had to do, right? To safeguard this information. That wasn't necessary, right? Because they flew the mission as planned. They struck the target, and I did some homework on this. Interesting, because I'm a bomber pilot, right? So I'm wondering, how close were they? And this is interesting, Adam. I think it'll be interesting to your audience. So this is high-altitude daylight bombing, right? We call it kind of precision bombing, but you know, they had the Norden bombsight. What's interesting about the Norden bombsight is it was new. So my grandfather did use the Norden bombsight on their Ruin mission. It was very new at that point back in 1942. Right now we're in 45. They had been practicing with the bomb site. Tom Farabee was the expert. Interestingly, when they were at Wendover, they were missing the target by some random amount of error, and they couldn't figure out why. So one day my grandfather was watching Tom, and he said, "Tom, I'm just going to watch you do this exactly as you've been doing it every time." And what he noticed was Tom would be, you know, looking at the bomb site. He would have the aim point. And right before he would, you know, release, he would want to get the best view he could. And he would pick his body up and kind of get a better view down the bomb site. And what that caused was just a little bit of error. Well, a little bit of error at 30,000 feet is a lot of error.
Yes.
And so my grandfather had him design a headrest, a literal headrest that they put on the Norden bomb site that every time Tom put his head on the, and any bombardier did, on the bomb site, it was in the exact same position every time. Pretty ingenious,
yeah.
Huh?
It is, pretty ingenious. So,
we won't take any bets because you might already know the answer to this, but they were extremely close to the target, within a few hundred feet, from 30,000 feet with the Norden bomb site. And so we've come a long way, right? The mission over Ruin, about half of the bombs that were dropped within the target area. So that was the beginning, right, of bombing, and they were bombing at 23,000 feet to where we were at this point in time, where they could be extremely accurate. I mean, that's accuracy close to our unguided bombs today. I mean, we're a little more accurate than that. I'll say that.
Sure.
But still, right? Still, that's impressive. That's impressive. So the bomb went off on time. They started the escape maneuver. In the escape maneuver, as I mentioned before, they were max performing the B-29, right? So he racked it up to a steep angle. It was a descending, a slight descent, so they could maximize to the stick shaker, maximize the G on the airplane to get away from the maneuver. So for those that aren't familiar with flying or Gs, what I'm talking about here is turning the airplane to a bank angle of almost 60 degrees. So you would never in a commercial airline, if you're ever at 60 degrees, something's probably not right. You're maybe at 30 degrees, about half that. So 90 degrees would be this way, right? 90 degrees would be, you know, okay, it's just for your audience, would be where the wings are no longer horizontal. They're completely vertical. That's 90 degrees. So he was close to that at 60. And then pulling the column back until it starts to shake. And then in a slight descent so that the airplane doesn't stall, you don't lose airspeed, and then holding that for that entire turn of 120 degrees in a slight descent. So that was the maneuver. This is not for the weak. This is a pretty, I will say violent, but it's aggressive. But that's what was required to get away from this blast. Now, I know you're probably thinking, well, did they really get away? And if you've done any reading about it, you'll understand they rolled out and they're flying away from the blast now. And then they get the shockwave from the blast. One of the crewmen came over the interphone and said, hey, flak. I think the term was flak. The flak, you know, in other words, they're getting shot at. And my grandfather said, no. That's not flak. That's actually the shockwave from the bomb itself. And so they did. It did jolt the airplane. It was several G's. I mean, it was. They recorded all of this. And my grandfather said he felt a tingling in his teeth, in his fillings, right, from the effects of the blast. So this was serious business. After that, they did maneuver a little bit. There was some more video and you know footage that was taken. They had the other airplane that was doing that as well, and continued on back to home to Tinian. And then clearly, you know, the crowds were waiting when they landed. If you've ever seen any footage of this, there's a huge crowd when they land. Successful mission. And my grandfather received the Distinguished Service Cross, which is the award right under the Medal of Honor for his actions, you know, that for leading up to and then executing the mission.
And then so now the mission's happened, you know, what? Is it time to go home? What do we do now?
Right. So you hear my grandfather talk about the elation, right, that this war's coming to an end. I always say, and my grandfather would say the same thing, any loss of life is tragic. So that needs to be said, and it needs to be understood, because we are trying to celebrate, in my grandfather's words, we're trying to stop the killing. We're trying to stop the bloodshed. And he and his crew, that's what drove them. There was an interview done years later with the surviving members of the crew. And my grandfather had a really nice quote at the end that said, look, if people just understood that all we really wanted was this war to come to an end, that we're patriots like everyone else, right? We're Americans and we want the war to end. We want people to come home. And that can't be overstated, I don't think, because we get lost sometimes in the destruction of something like a bomb like this. We forget about the real reason that it was used in the first place, right? Which is we're trying to end the war. We did everything we could. We tried everything. And the Japanese had decided they're not going to surrender. And so these were tough times, Adam. These were tough times.
Oh, sure.
And so to answer your question, that's a lead into your question, but we know that the Japanese did not surrender after the first bomb. The second, excuse me, I'm sorry. The second bomb was one of the pumpkin bombs I spoke of earlier. And that airplane was commanded by his squadron commander, Chuck Sweeney, who later became a general, General Sweeney. And that mission took place on August 9th. And so between the 6th and the 9th, they're preparing for the second mission. They're looking at the targets again. A little bit different situation here, because although the setup was the same, the primary target was obscured. As a matter of fact,
and let me ask you, your grandfather is still in command of both of these.
He is.
Because it's the same, it's the 509th for both.
That's right.
They're still all at Tinian, and they've got these couple bombs, and then there's a potential that more bombs could be coming if the Japanese don't surrender. And so they're going to be there till the end.
Correct. Yes. And great point, Adam. And I will add too that the questions people asked my grandfather, are you going to fly the second mission? He goes, no. He said, you know, I'm going to hand that off to the other men that have been preparing for this. And of course, his squadron commander was the natural choice, General Sweeney. So yes, he's still in command. They have trained the same. All the training's the same, right? Everybody's prepared. And the maneuvers after really everything is going to be conducted in the same fashion. The only difference this time is that there's weather over Japan now. So there was some concern about the success of the second mission. And it was challenging. If you read the details that General Sweeney had to go through, or Colonel Sweeney at the time, it was rough. They went over the primary target was obscured. They were looking at Nagasaki, and they decided to go to the secondary target. It was obscured. At the last minute, they got enough clearance to be able to drop the bomb. It was close. But it wasn't perfect conditions. That bomb was not quite as close to the target because of the conditions they were in, but it still achieved the effect that we were looking for. And so we were really proud of that crew. We're really proud that they were able to succeed and come back, and that event, like we'll say both events combined, led to the end of World War II and the primary objective of saving lives and bringing our men home to fight another day.
Yeah, it seems a lot of people may not quite understand just how, for many people that had been fighting their way in the island hopping campaign and had fought the Japanese in Okinawa and, you know, had fought these other islands, they knew how brutal the Japanese were. They fought to the death, and they knew it was going to be a brutal fight, and they saw heavy American casualties, and they thought, if they'll fight like this on islands like these, how hard will they fight for their own home islands? And so all of these American soldiers who were not looking forward to being a part of that campaign. And I don't, you know, my wife's grandfather was a B-17 pilot, and he, you know, on his third mission, his co-pilot was killed in the seat next to him. And he had, you know, flew back, and then he completed his 25 missions. And then the very next mission after he, you know, after he left, because you had to fly 25, his aircraft was shot down. So, you know, for people that don't understand, this was a terrible war that was, you know, the 8th Air Force had the worst casualties of anybody. You know, if you were an airman at that time, this was a very dangerous business. And people can just lose sight of that when they can sometimes be critical of what the United States did there. So now the Japanese have surrendered. And what does your grandfather do at that point?
Right. Yeah. So, and if I can add, Adam, the enormity and the magnitude of this conflict is if you actually study it and you look at the lives that were lost, it's hard to fathom. A million lives were lost a month, you know, if you do the math. And the reason I looked at that one day is I was wondering, as we talk about nuclear deterrence, that's not probably what we're doing in this conversation, but when you start to look at what does that mean, and you talked in the intro about not having wars of these superpowers at war together. That's what it means. So Vietnam, yeah, tragic. But the entire loss of life in Vietnam over a extended period of time was similar to a month during World War II. And so I think it's important to mention that. I think it's important to just put your arms around that, because these men that were fighting, clearly all of them celebrated the opportunity to bring this war to an end. And yes, it's tragic when lives are lost, but we save so many more. So I'll accelerate now. So yeah, the war's over. My grandfather is now, they're wrapping up their time on Tinian and they're returning. And really the next few chapters in his book, when he talks about, okay, what's the rest of the story for Paul Tibbetts, was he continued to serve until 1959. He actually was promoted to brigadier general, but because of a story I haven't told you yet, that promotion was delayed by a significant number of years. I'll give you the brief version now that I've mentioned it, because your listeners will go, what's the story? The story is that General Doolittle asked my grandfather to serve on planning staff that planned the bombing missions after his initial time in the B-17. He said, we need to get an operator in there, someone that understands what's happening. Someone's a little bit more senior, like my grandfather, that can provide some expertise, having been there, right, having flown, and knowing the implications of different decisions that could be made by the planning staff. And so he was sent to headquarters and told to be that, I'll call it voice of reason, to help in this planning of future missions. This was on the heels of some of the missions we'd flown. So my grandfather, I mentioned before, in Ruin, flew at 23,000 feet. We also later on flew some missions at lower altitude. And you can imagine and you've read about the Bloody 100th. There's a lot of discussions about the different missions during World War II. And those ones flown at low altitude were very dangerous because of all the AAA, you know, the magnitude of ammunition that was being thrown up into the air in our aircraft. And we were losing hundreds and hundreds and thousands, you know, just many men were dying in airplanes that were lost during this time. So my grandfather was there to help with some of that. He went to the planning staff in his very first planning mission. They were planning on flying a low altitude mission again, which he had flown. He had flown one of those. And he said, the only reason that we were moderately successful in ours is because it was a surprise. But that was in 1942. Now we're fast forwarded to into mid 43. We've come a long way since then, and there's not a, it's not a surprise anymore. And so he made the decision to, even though he was told before the meeting, hey, the colonel just wants you to nod your head, do what you're told. Right? There's a lot going on. We've thought through all this, and this is the plan. Well, my grandfather thought, well, that, as I said before, he didn't say this, but I said, that's interesting, but not compelling. So in the briefing, this mission came up as a restrike at low altitude on a target we've already struck. And my grandfather stood up and he said, Colonel, I'd like to just offer an opinion or a thought about this. And he explained from his own experience what this could likely mean. And the colonel just was not terribly interested in that. And he said, well, Paul, and they went back and forth a little bit, just in the sense of time, I'll just accelerate this, but they went back and forth a little bit. And finally, my grandfather, unfortunately, got a little upset, you know, and he's not an emotional guy, but he's passionate. And he's particularly passionate about the men that they're talking about flying this mission because he just flew with them, right? In B-17s. And he knew that he needed to say something. So he, in a sense, kind of, you know, stood up, you know, in a forceful way and said, Colonel, I'll agree to this mission if you'll fly it and I'll fly as your co-pilot. Well, if you think about that for a minute, that didn't go over so well. No. And so the good news was, is that they did change the mission and they did fly at a higher altitude. They went back to more of the high altitude bombing we've talked about before. The bad news is this individual remembered that for the rest of his life. And so after the war, he this individual continued to get promoted, and he made sure that my grandfather never got promoted above 06 until he passed away. And that's why people always ask, why did your grandfather not get promoted, as I mentioned, until, I may have said this wrong, but he got promoted to Brigadier General in 1959. He retired in 1966, the year I was born. So if I said that wrong before, 1959, why did it take so long? Well, this individual had to pass away, and then General McConnell, which McConnell Air Force Base is named after, was a friend of my grandfather's, and he's the one that that ensured that he got promoted. He said, you deserve to be a brigadier general before you retire. He had an interesting career. He was part of the test group in the B-47. He was one of General LeMay, prior to that, one of General LeMay's fix-it guys, and went to a couple of different units to help turn those units around. As we've talked about, fantastic leader, knows how to identify a problem, knows how to eradicate that and move on. But you know, his career was not moving fast, I'll say, in any stretch. And so he made the decision to retire in 1966.
Yeah. And so for, you know, when you have the time to reflect and to think back, and I'm sure people for the rest of his life would ask him that sort of that fundamental question of, you know, do you regret it or would you do it again? That kind of thing. What did he say about that?
One of my favorite stories comes from that discussion, Adam, with him, and it's when he met with President Truman, which we're going to be at the Truman Library. Looking forward to that. But President Truman had him and General Spatz, General Doolittle, to his office in 1948 when my grandfather was actually stationed at the Pentagon. He had these gentlemen come and meet in his office, and I don't know if you've heard this story, but the short version is that of course, General Spatz, first chief of the Air Force, right? General Doolittle, we know what he did, right? Flying B-25s off a carrier. High-ranking gentlemen later in their careers, fantastic leaders. And my grandfather, and he's like, and then there's me. Why do they have this washed-up colonel, he was a colonel at the time, you know, here meeting with the president? And he didn't mean that pejoratively. He just meant, I'm not sure he wants to maybe thank me or just say, hey, you did a good job, right? So he showed up. They got in the president's office. Interestingly, my grandfather was placed to the side of President Truman. The other folks were placed in front of President Truman, and he addressed them first, thanked them for the accomplishments that they had during the war and the you know, what that time period is, you know, respectfully to each one of them. And they said, you know, thank you, Mr. President. That went on for some time, and my grandfather was just sitting there. And then at some point, my grandfather said he turned and he just looks at me for a few seconds, like he's, you know, he's thinking. He looks at him and goes, so, Paul, what do you think? And my grandfather said, well, Mr. President, I think I did what I was supposed to. And President Truman, my grandfather said he slammed his fist on his desk right in front of him. He said, you're damn right you did. And I'm the one who sent you. If anybody ever gives you a hard time about it, you send them to me. And so to your question, Adam, about, you know, how was it afterwards for my grandfather? Because he lived until, you know, he was almost 93 years old. He died in 2007. Wow. He saw a lot in that time period. And he would tell you, well, that meeting with President Truman was pretty impactful because his message, I got loud and clear, right? Hey, Paul, you did your job and you did it well. I'm the one responsible for that mission. And I'm the one that bears the burden of those kinds of comments. And, you know, he's kind of looking into the future now. You might hear in your life, you don't know what people are going to say later, but I think he did. I think the president, he obviously did, because he's telling my grandfather, look. And my grandfather, you know, early on, of course, it was, hey, you know, we ended this war. As we get later in time and more generations are upon us and you get a little bit of that revisionist history, and not that, you know, we don't celebrate, we do celebrate everyone's right to believe what they want to believe, right? But I always say that we need to couch that with the facts. You know, we need to be careful not to reinvent something or change history. But we can always debate that. We can discuss that. And I celebrate that. That's what America's all about, right? But my grandfather, and he was okay. And I heard many times him have conversation with folks. Now, normally it was a friendly audience during his book signings and that during that time period. So, but to come back to the situation, he took that message to heart. He retired in 66. He ran a company called Executive Jet Aviation, which is now NetJets. It's the largest air taxi service in the world. He ran that company for 20 years, and then Warren Buffett bought it. And now he runs it out of Columbus, Ohio, which is why my grandfather lived in Columbus, Ohio. And then in 1987, when he left that company, he put a book out and spent the next 20 years or so giving talks, telling his story, signing his books. And he didn't charge much. He said, Paul, I'm not here to make money. I just want to get the story out. I want to get the word out. And I want everyone to hear it from me, because I was there. So yeah. He was encouraged to put the book out, and we're so glad he did. The book's out of print now, but we're glad that he did. And I'm grateful to the time that he spent with the folks that he spent it with over that time period, telling his story and explaining why the events took place. He never, in his words, he said, I never ever apologized for what we did, because I felt like it was absolutely the right thing to do. And he also said that people take offense sometimes when I say I never lost a night's sleep. And that's only because what we did, you know, we felt like would help bring this war to an end, and it did. Every loss of life that happened, he said, it's tragic, but all the Americans, as you said, Adam, all the loss of life prior to that time was terrible. And so he said, I'm glad that we had an opportunity to bring this war to an end. And he said, oh, you'd always say, my small part. I'm like, yeah, granddad, you're a small part. My part in this, you know, was something that I was very passionate about, and you know, the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, and it's sort of been interesting to see how people have recast it differently, you know, and so it's certainly good, you know, that's part of why having you on is such a great opportunity, so that we can sort of get a, you know, the truest sense of what it was like and who your grandfather was and why he did what he did. So, you know, thanks for being here to do that. It's just a great opportunity. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't bring out Bob the Genie and rub my magic lamp. So I have to give you, Bob gives every single guest 3 wishes. Now, I don't want to, you know, deny you your 3 wishes. So as I grant you your 3 wishes, you know, Paul, what is wish number one?
Well, I know we're supposed to focus on what we've talked about, right, Adam? So I will tell you this. Thanks. And I appreciate that opportunity. I think I want to, my first wish, I want to piggyback on what I just said.
Sure.
My first wish is that in schools today that we would do, I think, a better job of educating young people on what happened in World War II, why it happened. We don't have to talk about my grandfather necessarily, and he would not want that. But he would want us to talk about what was going on and the reasons that we made the decisions that we did. And the reason I mention that is because I talk to young people today, and I want to get a sense of kind of what they're being taught. And there's not a lot of that of being taught anymore. Maybe we'll get back to that. I don't know. But I think education, because if we can do that, Adam, then we can do that next part that I mentioned before, different conversation than today. But what is all this nuclear deterrence about? What you celebrate, Adam, what you talk about all the time, what does that mean? Why is that important? Why are we spending billions of dollars on a deterrent in a physical form that, as I say all the time, and I would like to, I wish this could be taught, you know, part of this teaching, we use it every day. People say, well, we're all this money. We're just wasting all this money. I go, no, we're not. No, we're not. A deterrent, in fact, is there for to deter. So we use it every day. Every penny we spend, it's nothing compared to the budget. It's nothing compared to the big scheme of things. But what it provides for our nation is a level of security, right? It's a blanket, but it's the foundation of that security. Without the foundation, it's like your house. Without the foundation, everything falls apart. Well, the nuclear deterrent is the foundation. It's absolutely necessary, but we don't explain that. We don't help people understand that. So I'll get off my soapbox, Adam, because that's, you know, maybe, you know, you and I've talked about this before. That's number one. How's that?
Okay. So that's number one. Okay. So now wish number two.
I think wish number two, staying within the theme we're talking about today, in this, you know, the world we're in today, is that from all sides of beliefs in America, you know, from everyone that's out there, that we have a better grasp that everybody's opinion is important. You know, I've often said, look, I may not agree with you. And that's fine, because that'd be strange, right? I mean, if we all agree with each other, what a boring place it would be. But that we respect each other's opinions for the opinion, you know, for what it is, as opposed to having some idea that, well, if you don't think like me, then, you know, there's that, right? You know, I'm not going to say you're wrong, but yeah, you're wrong. And I'm not saying everybody's like that, Adam, because they're not. But I have certainly come across in my time, in my life, and you have as well, where that's become an issue. I love a heated debate, and I love to have a discussion about topics that are maybe, you know, let's just say different people have different beliefs on. Sure. I love that, but it's in a respectful way, right? Let's do that and let's respect one. So when we're done, I told my daughter one time, I said, you know, look, Avery, we are absolutely not going to agree on everything. But what I would like to do is have a conversation with you so that when we're done, we still respect each other, but we understand that there are different viewpoints and different ways to look at things. And we've tried to teach our kids that, Adam, and that's a thing in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be an improvement on the current state of affairs for sure. So,
right.
Okay. Right. So your final wish now, final wish.
My final wish. Well, like in Miss Congeniality, Adam, I just want world peace. I'm just kidding. I mean, I do want world peace. We all want world peace. We have to remember that back to Thucydides, that, you know, since the beginning of man, there's not been world peace, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't strive for that. I give it some tongue in cheek there, but we do that through things like we've talked about, like the nuclear deterrent. We find ways to be more stable, to find an environment that's more stable. So a third thing. I served for 30 years in the Air Force, and I absolutely love my time in the Air Force. And I enjoy my time now, you know, working in the defense industry, and trying to find ways to help contribute to the broader perspective. So I think my third wish would be that we continue to strive towards funding things that are at the highest levels that get to those points I made earlier, right? Education, but also deterrence, and also, you know, those ideas that this foundation that we have, you know, you got to put your money where your mouth is. You know, you really do. And so there's a lot of discussion today in our government about what that should look like. And I don't personally like the argument of, let's just talk about like numbers, like we need this many of that or miss many of that. But I do, you know, if you think about just weapons, for example, like in a conventional weapons, we have a large variety of conventional weapons, right? The B-2 just dropped the 30,000-pound mop. That's a whole lot different than a 500-pound weapon, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, and those are designed for different purposes. Well, I think in the nuclear enterprise, we need more diversity as well. I think we just need more diversity because the president is going to want options. If we're forced down this road of some type of nuclear escalation and we need to respond to it, he needs options, or she needs options, right? That, you know, the future presidents, they're going to need options. And we don't have a lot of good options right now. No. And so I think my third wish is that there could be a recognition that, look, we're not celebrating nuclear weapons, you know, far from it, but we are celebrating the utility of this deterrent, the necessity of it, actually, the necessity of it. And I'll never apologize for that. You know, I'm just like my grandfather. Look, you don't put the genie back in the bottle. You know, that's just a silly argument. Global zero, no. We're in a different place today, and let's treat it as serious as it is and find a way to build a effective deterrent over a large different area options that the president might need.
Well said. I agree. You know, it's, you know, for some reason, diversity is good, except with nuclear weapons. I would say it's equally good with nuclear weapons. So I agree with you there. So, well, interesting story. We're glad to have you on NucleCast. It was great to hear about your grandfather and get your take on it and to have you here. And we're going to add this to, for our listeners, we're going to add this to our series that we have on that is for our historical context that, you know, we've talked to all the historians from the labs and we've Manhattan, you know, the Manhattan Project historians, we've talked to all of them. So this is going to be a key component of that because it's been one of those missing stories that we haven't had. So thanks for being here to share it and to add that context for our listeners.
Well, clearly my pleasure, Adam. Thank you for having me. And I love the work you do. You can tell I'm a little bit passionate about this, but again, for all the right reasons. You know, my grandfather was fantastic, and if I can do some little part to help carry on his message while making it current, then that's a good thing in my mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, thanks to you for being here, and of course, thanks to all listeners. We appreciate you listening. And of course, we'll see you on the next episode. Well, what a great discussion. You know, it's one of those things, if you've never heard Newt talk about, you know, his grandfather and sort of what was, you know, a pivotal mission in the history of the world. So it was great to have him on. Great to have that discussion. And hopefully you don't mind. It's a little longer of an episode. Hopefully you still hung with it. So great stories, interesting, and, you know, historical.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at Nuclecast.